Welcome to the Green Alliance podcast. We are the charity and think tank that is all about achieving ambitious leadership for the environment. My name is Sean Spears, and I'm Executive Director of Green Alliance. Today, I'm talking to Professor Natalie Tocci, author of a fascinating book, A Green and Global Europe, published by Polity. Dr. Tocci is Director of Italy's Institute of International Affairs, the Istituto Affari Internazionali. So, Natalie, thanks very much indeed for doing the podcast. You've written this great book, A Green and Global Europe. It starts with a really optimistic statement about how the Green project can kind of rejuvenate the EU project generally. You say, by painting its flag green, the EU has found the recipe to help save the planet while reviving itself politically. Why don't you just say a little bit more about the thesis and what brought you to write the book?
Well, thanks, Sean, and thanks for the invitation. So I would say that the book starts from two, in a sense, fairly basic premises. Premise number one, the energy transition will happen. And it's not the first energy transition, and it will not be the last, right? I mean, there have been many other transitions in the past, from wood to coal, coal to oil and gas. There will be the transition away from fossil fuels, simply because it will make economic sense and it will be driven by technological change. Now, there is obviously a difference between this transition and previous transitions, which essentially has to do with the fact that this transition is not, quote unquote, only driven by technology and market forces, but also, and perhaps primarily, driven by the awareness that we are in an existential crisis, which is the climate crisis. And therefore, the speed and the complexity, as also because obviously the world has become a bigger and more complex place compared to how it was when previous transitions took place, but especially the speed at which this transition has to happen is really what makes the difference. So the premise number one is this is not a question about whether it will happen, but there are a set of questions which have to do with the pace and the mode in which this will happen. Premise number two, which gets to the European side of the story, the EU, and specifically the European Integration Project, has been in sort of existential crisis really for the best part of the last 15, perhaps even 20 years, right? You know, beginning with the constitutional crisis in 2005, then hopping on to the Eurozone crisis, then moving on to the migration crisis. Then, of course, there was the Brexit crisis, the fear that this would trigger a domino effect across the Union, the nationalist populist wave. Then, of course, came the pandemic. And then, of course, more recently, there's been Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And in all of this, a constant, especially in the first three crises, constitutional crisis, Eurozone, migration, as well as Brexit, there was this growing detachment between the European project, EU institutions, and citizens. So, you know, the green agenda comes in as something that really manages to sort of kill several birds with one stone. So firstly, it addresses that climate crisis, which is kind of essential because unless we do, we will just all fry whether we're European or not. Secondly, it is obviously something that is considered as the most important priority for especially younger generations. And so this idea of a European project detached from what really matters, in a sense, you know, that gap is filled by Europe painting its flag green by addressing the number one priority for, you know, European citizens, especially European citizens of the future. And then, and perhaps this is potentially one of the most interesting stories, but one where actually it remains to be seen whether we manage to get this right. The idea that this is a project which is about production, creativity, growth, opportunity. This is not a Europe that is simply once again associated with rules and restrictions and bans. This is not the austerity Europe. This is a productive Europe. So it's a way basically also to change the image that European institutions have been associated with. So perfect, perfect, perfect. It's going to happen. It has to happen and it should happen. Great. Then that's where the optimism actually ends in the sense that actually the rest of the book is basically intended to highlight that you know, although the destination is great, the journey is going to be bumpy. Because yes, it's true that we talk about this as a transition, but in some respects, it's more akin to a revolution. If we think about the speed and the complexity of the endeavor. And therefore, if we're serious about it, and for the reasons that I was mentioning earlier, we have to be serious about it, we really have to think through what the social, economic, political, and geopolitical implications are. So actually, the bulk of the book focuses not on that optimistic story, but focuses on those challenges. Because my conviction is that unless we address those challenges and we do so effectively, either we're not going to do the transition on time, or there will be, I guess it's part of the same thing, boomerang effects, you know, negative consequences that are going to kind of bounce back into our faces. And so we should be thinking about, you know, as we paint our flag green, we should be facing head on what are the challenges, rather than painting it rosy green, kind of realizing that in some respects it will be a difficult journey.
Natalie, I was going to come on to that. So I think what we've seen in the EU is really strong leadership, putting the green narrative right at the centre of the politics, from Ursula von der Leyen, Frans Timmermans. You pointed out the previously energy kind of outfought climate within the Commission. Now it doesn't. There's a senior vice president of the Commission pushing on climate. All that's good. But as you say, there's a history of disunity within the EU. There's potential expansion to 35 or 36 states. You point out the security challenge, the challenge of finding money for defence as well as for going green is going to be huge. There aren't, I don't know if you think Emmanuel Macron sort of plays the part of this sort of senior states person in Europe now, but Angela Merkel's gone. It's not so clear that there's that kind of strong leadership coming out from outside the Commission. And there's a lot of pushback from other parts of the union. And I just wonder if you're as optimistic, you know, your book was very clear about the challenges, but it is an optimistic book. And a year on, I wonder if you're still as optimistic, seeing the pushback from Hungary, some of the concerns of workers about just transition, the election in Italy, et cetera, et cetera, whether you still think this is something that can be pulled off.
I guess the answer is yes, I am. And I think the fact that we're beginning to have that pushback can be read as something that risks, you know, derailing or at the very least slowing down. And that's, you know, certainly a risk. You could also interpret it as the fact that this is real. It means it's really happening, right? I mean, it's easy to all agree when something is abstract and, you know, climate, climate, climate. All of a sudden, this is not just a lofty goal. I mean, this is beginning to be political, yeah, because policy decisions are being made. And as I said, it's a transition that is more akin to a revolution, and revolutions have winners and losers. And so I think if there weren't to be any pushback, it means that the action hadn't actually started yet. The fact that there is pushback is something that, you know, things can go wrong. Yes, absolutely. But the fact that it seems to me that now that some of the action has started, and we can discuss whether it's enough, whether it's going in the right direction, but things are happening. All of a sudden, the pushback starts. Good. It means it's real. And then the debate has to become, are we doing enough to persuade and to compensate the losers? Because I think there's a big story of compensation that in theory, we understand, in the sense that, yes, we have something called the Just Transition Fund. Yes, we have a European Climate Social Fund. But I think in terms of the magnitudes that we should be talking about, we're nowhere near what we should be talking about. And let me just give you a couple of numbers by way of comparison. If you add together the European Climate Social Fund and the Just Transition Fund, we're basically in the order of about 60 billion for the 7-year European budget. So through to 2027, starting obviously a couple of years ago. If you think of how much money has been spent across the EU, and in this figure that I'm, otherwise I'm cheating a little bit, in this figure that I'm giving you, actually the UK and Norway is included, so it's not only EU, but still, in 1 year, to address the socio-economic effects of the energy crisis, so basically utility bills for both citizens and small and medium-sized enterprises, Europe spent 800 billion. So 60 billion, you know, for 7 years, 800 billion in 1.5 years. If you think that the whole next generation EU funds, post-pandemic funds, was 800 billion for 7 years. So yes, we understand that there is going to be issues about socioeconomic inequalities that we need to address, but the figures that we're talking about are still peanuts compared to what is needed. And unless we start getting serious on that, then there is the risk that you're referring to, that that pushback is going to become an overwhelming pushback. But I think that, as I said, the fact that it started to me is at the moment still simply, quote unquote, an indication that the change is actually beginning to happen.
Yeah, and I don't want to get depressing about it, but those sums are eye-watering. And one of the striking things about your book is that it focuses on energy, on the energy transition. From a UK perspective, the transition, it's not that the energy transition is done, but we got off coal earlier. We've had offshore wind. So if you think of the big numbers where you're going to get real emissions reductions, they're on things like transport and industry as much as energy. Though energy obviously is a part of those things as well. And globally, agriculture is a really big story. And agriculture is a kind of such a difficult topic in the EU. That's one area where there really has been pushback, isn't it?
Absolutely. And there will be real pushback on agriculture. I mean, agriculture is the one thing that we're only, I wouldn't say we're even beginning to really scratch the surface of it. So yes, you're right. You know, I'm focusing mainly on the 75% part of the problem and not the 25% left, in the sense that, you know, 3/4 indeed is about the energy transition. And as you say, this is certainly true in the UK, as in similar story in Italy, but in other countries, obviously not. In a sense, countries like Italy and the UK have done the easy, quote unquote, part. I mean, they've done the coal part, and we still have, you know, the gas part to address. And then on top of this, I think there is the even, which goes way beyond Europe, but we're not going to be able to electrify everything. So molecules are still going to be part of the picture. And how do we make sure that we decarbonize those molecules? What role is there in the short to medium term for carbon capture and storage? And going way beyond that, what kind of investments need to happen to make renewables as we know today almost look prehistoric? You know, so what is it that we should be talking about in a sense, in terms of, I don't know, nuclear fusion? Where is it that the real investment has to take place? And coming back to the Europe question, beyond the incentivizing renewables as we know them, the transition as we know it, are we really doing enough in order to invest in the innovation, in the research that can actually lead to a real step change? Because I think on the trajectory that we're on, things aren't looking great, in all honesty, right? One's always a little bit conflicted about overstating the fact that, you know, sort of, you don't want to make something look too daunting, otherwise it simply kind of, you know, immobilizes. But in fairness, it kind of is, right? Pretty daunting.
But there's a shed load of money now going into all this stuff, not only in the EU, the US is throwing money at it. I mean, it may have sort of underplayed the regulatory aspects and it's perhaps late to the party, but there's a lot of money going in. A lot of that will be for innovation as well. I don't know if you've got a take yet on the Green Deal industrial plan, whether that's going to meet some of these innovation challenges.
So this is a really interesting one. Now, pre-Inflation Reduction Act, Europe had its European Green Deal that was basically aimed at one thing, which is decarbonisation. Great, fantastic. And how do you do it? Well, you do it through a mix of different things, a bit of regulation, carbon pricing, a bit of finance. I mean, as long as if finance was not there, I mean, 40% of next generation EU funds were supposed to be, are in fact, on green. So there was this kind of, you know, fairly comprehensive package, and it was aimed, as I said, at one thing, and that was climate. Then comes the Inflation Reduction Act. Now, I think the IRA puts Europeans on the spot, because IRA is only, on one level, of course, it's aimed at the same thing, but on a deeper level, it's as much, if not more, aimed at China than at the transition. So it's basically trying to do two things at the same time. And Europe hadn't thought about the China piece. Yeah, I mean, the Green Deal was about decarbonization. I mean, China was off the map. I mean, yes, you know, we were starting to have a conversation about new dependencies and critical minerals and all of the rest of it, but we were single-handedly focused on objective number one. Now, the US, as I said, on one level, it puts us in a difficult spot because all of a sudden we realize, I mean, if we have to address two sets of goals, I mean, not one, well, we have to kind of come up with a whole load more of kind of new cash. And where are we going to get that from? And especially, how are we going to get it in a way that doesn't further exacerbate inequalities, in this case, not so much within states, but between them in Europe, given that if there aren't going to be many more EU level funds, then you're into national funds. And hence the discussion about relaxing state aid rules, which basically means that countries with greater fiscal space like Germany will be able to put more money on this than states like Italy, for example. And then the question is, you know, the Commission's proposal for an industry act, is that going in the right direction? Is that a kind of copycat version of the IRA and actually leading Europeans to sort of fall into the trap of protectionism, which, you know, one thing is the United States is doing what it's doing because it wants to compete with China. In fact, it wants to outcompete China. The EU kind of isn't really into this outcompeting China game. I mean, we don't have those kind of sort of aspirations. But in a sense, we're moving in a similar direction. So I'm not entirely sure, but I'll come back to this in a moment, but simply to close off the reflection actually on the IRA. So on one level, you could say, well, Europe in a difficult spot. On another level, though, you could actually say, well, is this actually sustainable for the United States? The reason why the US has an IRA is because more funds is the only thing that Democrats and Republicans could agree to in an approach of competing with China. Forget decarbonization. This is about competing with China. Both agree that that's number one priority. And so they just put a load of cash onto that question. How many IRAs? I mean, this is not a short-term game, right? I mean, this is going to take decades. How many $370 billion packages can you cough up every few years, basically? And isn't it more sustainable to have Europe's approach, which is basically a mix of regulation and finance and pricing? Can the US really do decarbonization without carbon pricing? I'm not entirely convinced it's possible, because ultimately, if what you need to have is create a price differential between green and brown, yes, obviously you want to incentivize green, but you kind of also need to tax brown. I mean, you've got to do both at the same time. You can't just do one and not the other, unless you, as I said, want to spend so much money so many times. I think actually in Europe, we've been kind of, you know, sort of pulling our hair out over the IRA. There are very good reasons to kind of think hard about this question. But I actually do think that there is a US question, which the US is not even beginning to address.
It's all carrots and no sticks. And I guess they're gambling on all the investment flooding in to the States. But I think I'll come on to the UK position, because the UK green NGOs, organisations like Green Alliance, who've been saying that the future of post-Brexit UK is to go seriously for the green transition. And I still think that's the answer. But we are stuck between these two behemoths now, kind of going head to head on it. What I think your book is really strong on is the consequences for the rest of the world. The 600 million people in Africa without electricity, massively growing population. You describe climate in foreign policy as an afterthought at best. Climate still represents an appendix of foreign policy, including security and defence. You know, how can the EU and the US go head to head on getting green investment? The EU set an increasingly stringent carbon price, get serious about carbon border adjustment mechanisms, keeping out trade from countries that perhaps don't have the money to decarbonize. How can all that happen without kind of massive global injustice in the world? You set out a few ideas, but in a way, I think the other interesting thing is, how can that become part of the narrative? Because it simply isn't part of the foreign policy narrative, actually, either in the UK, since David Miliband was foreign secretary, has there been a foreign secretary who took that really seriously, and not in the EU, as far as I understand it.
So, okay, one more pessimistic note and then a more optimistic, perhaps, way to end this as well. So on the pessimism, I'm convinced that we can only do this in a, globally speaking, in a cooperative manner. I don't believe in a world in which we're going to address the climate crisis only or even primarily through competition. I mean, it is not by, you know, China, the US and Europe trying to outcompete one another that we can fix this. Yes, it's going to be an element of it, but unless the predominant element is a cooperative one, it is not going to happen. And in this respect, what we've been seeing is extremely worrying, right? Because those competitive dynamics have been increasingly damaging the multilateral framework. And of course, there are different reasons why Sharm el-Sheikh was not a smashing success, but I would argue that those growing competitive dynamics were part of it. Although, of course, you know, some coming to the justice part, you know, some important steps forward were made, at least in terms of putting the loss and damage issue on, you know, at least formally on the table. Now, on the more optimistic side of it, in terms of the relationship with the rest of the world, I think that what's quite interesting, and maybe this is still a relatively, I wouldn't say micro story, but perhaps still marginal story, but I think it's something that is beginning to happen, is actually related to the way in which Europe has been addressing the energy crisis as a result of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So here we are in a situation in which, oh, you know, we've got to wean ourselves off from Russian gas and we need to do so quickly. So part of that positive part of the story is that this has actually led to a rather remarkable uptick in renewables over the course of the last year, more so than expected. But coming to the relationship with the rest of the world, what has been interesting about it, let me give you an Italian example here. So Italy has basically looked for, as we've been looking for gas left, right and center, we have gone to countries like Algeria. I mean, this is the classic example. And we say to Algeria, well, you know, we would actually quite like to have more of your gas. Okay, fine. And Algeria says, well, what are you going to give us in return? And the answer has been, it's not just going to be about more investment in gas production. We have increased really rather dramatically our investments in Algeria's energy efficiency, carbon capture and storage and renewable production. So given that we will not be able to provide energy security only in a protectionist fashion, we will have a growing interest in investing in the transition of our neighbours. And this is mainly an Africa story. You could say, argue actually there could be in future, in hopefully the near future, even a Ukraine part of the story. In a pre-war world, it would have also been a Russia story. I can't quite see that happening, us investing in Russia's energy transition. But I think the bottom line is, you know, this connects also to conversations about, you know, nearshoring and friendshoring and all the rest of it and the broader debate about how globalization is reconfigured. But I think if we want to find a synthesis between the energy security and the energy transition, there is a strong incentive in creating the incentives to invest in, you know, greening partnerships basically with our neighbors.
So there are good stories within the story. The overall story on EU foreign policy, as portrayed in your book, though, is that that is, as I say, an afterthought. Or I quote you saying, as an afterthought. It's not a part of the central narrative. It's a bit like in the UK. The UK has been very serious about climate finance, but that has come from some strong ministers within the machine fighting their corner. But it's not, you know, when the foreign secretary gives a big speech on the UK's foreign policy priorities, climate development, global justice, they're all afterthoughts at best.
Yeah, I think you're right. Let me put it in these terms. I think that it's only going to become the story, the main narrative, the minute in which it becomes clear how intertwined these issues are. Internally, it's happening. So internally, we no longer have a climate conversation which is detached from the conversation about fiscal policy and finance and infrastructure and in general economic policy, right? So now we understand that this is the same thing. It's not some marginal thing out there. I think that that mental switch hasn't happened yet as much as it should in terms of foreign policy. I do, though, think the fact that Russia's war on Ukraine has brought energy front and center actually does mean that this is the first step to realizing that this is not a nice thing to do on the margins. You know, you adding climate to a few council conclusions and kind of pretending to do climate and foreign policy. I think all of a sudden it's becoming increasingly clear that this is part of the tough part, yeah? Because again, it is linked to the economy. You know, sort of geoeconomics in general has become a far more prominent feature in foreign policy than it used to be. And energy is right at the heart of that. So I think it is beginning to happen, although in a sense, we haven't quite reconfigured our brains and especially our institutions in a sense to act systematically and systemically on that basis.
Great. So, Natalie, if I can end on a more parochial note about the UK. As you know, the UK and the EU, there's been a kind of Cold War since Brexit, and particularly since the Northern Ireland Protocol Bill. And one of the only areas where discussions have been able to carry on was over climate, and particularly around COP26. I wonder if you think now, you hardly mention the UK in your book, quite offensive to a UK reader. I was shocked and upset. But when we were talking about Brexit in the couple of years after the referendum vote and Green UK, which is the environmental coalition that Green Alliance has coordinated, was going over to Brussels, we were trying to get a post-Brexit agreement which would entail serious cooperation between the UK and the EU on the existential challenges of climate change and nature loss, which should sort of trump all other rivalries. And you do say in your book that the UK is sort of one of the major contributors to climate finance, and I think the 100 billion figure is a UK, EU plus UK figure. Do you think now that relations are calming down a little, that there could be a serious alliance between the UK and the EU on some of these issues?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. In fact, you know, the reason why I don't talk about the UK much is because, in a sense, we agree on, I mean, in some respects, it's a book that forgets about Brexit, because in many respects, you could, you know, I talk about Europe, the European Union. If we forget that Brexit even happened, the UK would have been right in the middle of all that, like any other major member state. Because there,
some of us can't forget about Brexit. That's the problem.
Yeah, I know. Yes. But connected actually to this and to the very obviously different climate since the Windsor Agreement, I actually do think that the future of EU-UK relations will necessarily pass probably through a phase of sectoral agreements, of which I would be extremely, extremely, extremely surprised if climate and the transition is not kind of the first one, you know, alongside security and defense, in the sense that these are really the two no-brainer areas, because interests are so, or not only interests, but policies are already so completely aligned that, in a sense, one ends up making the mistake in my book of even forgetting that Brexit ever happened.
I thought you were just miffed with Britain when you were mentioning this. But it was,
well, considering also that it was published by a UK publisher.
Great. Look, a couple of quick fire sort of unfair questions at the end, which I didn't alert you to, but I wonder if you could pick out one development, policy or political development in the EU in the last couple of years, which you think is going to make a real difference, and perhaps one area where you think there's a shortfall, where there needs to be much more of a focus.
So I think what has already made a big difference has been this war. You know, at the beginning of the war, there was a real fear, I would say, I was certainly very worried about it, the energy security back in, energy transition out. It has not happened. Now, you know, we can debate whether things could be done better, but the truth is that it has not happened. And I think this is really, really, really major. Where I think more attention should be placed is actually on this issue of less developed countries and their transition. And I relate it back to the same point. We've been extremely good in weaning off Russian gas, accelerating renewables, these green partnerships with some neighbours, fantastic, fantastic. But it's also true that we've been doing a hell of a lot of gas hoarding, and this has fueled further that sense of injustice that, you know, creates a completely toxic environment for climate diplomacy. I think that as we have gone past the peak of the energy crisis, we should redouble our efforts, not so much on what we do internally, but what we do with the rest of the world.
Great. Thanks so much, Natalie. Really, really fascinating stuff. I appreciate the time.
Great talking to you.
Thank you for listening to this Green Alliance podcast. Keep checking in as we will continue to bring you specialist interviews and highlights from our events here on your podcast feed. You can subscribe to the Green Alliance podcast on your favourite podcast app, and you can follow us on Twitter @Green Alliance UK. See you next time.